Welcome to Rights Radio for homeowners in distress, including condo owners, homeowner association members, and homeowners throughout the country. I'm your host, Dr. Joyce Starr, and this is the inaugural program of Rights Radio for homeowners. Our guest today is Dr. David Goldenberg, author of Creating Homeowner and Condo Association Documents, How to Protect Your HOA or Condo, which you can find on starpublications.com, that's star with two R's, S-T-A-R-R, publications, plural.com, or amazon.com, and barnesandnoble.com, also in your local bookstores. Good afternoon, David.
Good afternoon, Joyce. How are you?
Fine, and nice to have you with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
David, I understand you were featured on ABC television in Florida today. Can you please share with us the message of your important book?
Basically, I was asked about the validity of concerns in favor of more legislative protection for homeowners and condos and homeowner associations. And so there's a considerable need for the more protection in several forms. One is enforcement of existing rules, extension of the rules to provide greater coverage for people in condominiums and equal coverage to people in homeowners associations. There's also a need for education of people before they buy and of boards and credentialing of people on boards. Right now, the only restrictions on board service are that you be alive and not be a convicted felon without voting rights. But if you're illiterate, insane, or greedy or stupid or nasty, that doesn't disqualify you.
Well, that's very interesting. David, before we get into our interview, talking again about your book, what advice would you give to a condo owner or HOA member who suspects their documents were written poorly or illegally, perhaps, but doesn't have the resources to hire a lawyer to find out?
Well, you're going to have to work on your own then and probably spend some time with a law dictionary, the public library. Basically, you have to read the documents until you understand them. And that's difficult. Even lawyers have problems with that, it seems, and judges. But the first thing is to understand that your documents are subordinate to state law. If you live in a condominium, I believe it's Florida Statute 718 that controls, and if you live in a homeowners association, I believe it's Florida Statute 720, but I can never keep them straight.
Yes, I think you're right about that, but what if you don't live in Florida? What if you live in Michigan or Georgia?
Then the smart thing to do is call your attorney, your state attorney general's office, and ask which laws apply, and then look them up. You can do that on Fine Law or Mega Law, or go to a reference librarian in your public library, or if there's a law school nearby, go there.
Well, I want to come back to that as we go throughout our interview, but at the moment, I want to ask you, what, in your opinion, are the three or four things, most important things, for an owner to look for in their condo or HOA association documents? And what should one do if what they're looking for isn't there?
Well, that's part of what you're looking for. What is there and what isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have an explicit set of rules for the administration of the architectural committee and a similar set of rules for the grounds maintenance committee, you're in trouble already.
Because there are no rules, so they can impose rules that don't exist?
Well, the point is it falls back on judgment of the board. And your current board might have excellent judgment and great sensitivity to homeowners at the moment. But there's no guarantee that a future board will.
Well, for example, David, a woman contacted me today. The board has fined her over $5,000 for the color of her blinds. Her blinds are supposed to be white, but hers are brown because she has an elderly family member living with her who has Alzheimer's and can't see the color white. Now, the board has fined her $5,000, and the only thing that she can find in her rules is something that says the board can impose fines, $25 a day. It doesn't explain what the fines are for or could be used for, and there's nothing about imposing fines for the color of blinds. So what does a homeowner do in a situation like that?
Well, it depends on two things. One is what they've done before, if anything. If they've not been given notice and advance warning, then they're in a better position to act. But if they've ignored warnings and rules, they're in a weaker position. The second thing is how much you're willing to spend in money and time standing up for your rights. But the main thing would be to write a letter to the board so that everything's in writing and documented. Explain your circumstances and ask them to reconsider, in this case on medical grounds. And if they don't, you can make an argument that they're being arbitrary or capricious because there was no prior written rule.
But who would you make the argument to? If you can't find your state agency easily, or if the state agency is just a bare framework of an agency and not really very serious.
If they're in a condo in Florida, then you can talk to the Department of Business and Professional Regulation and the Condominium Administration Section.
But if they're not in Florida.
Pardon?
If
you're
not in Florida,
you'll have to look and see if there's a similar protective agency. If not, you might go to a small claims court, or you can go to the clerk of the court that has jurisdiction and ask for advice on how to file an injunction stopping this until you get a proper hearing. In Florida, you have to have a hearing, depending on the association, either by an arbitrator or a mediator. And while participation is, I believe, compulsory, acceptance of the decision is not automatic. So if you like the outcome, you could stand by it. If not, you can just refuse it.
Well, actually, you can refuse it, but nonetheless, if you lose in Florida, as was my experience in a very rigorous condo case, which we finally won after 2 years, if the arbitrator rules against you and you refuse it, the condo can take you to court and they will win. If the arbitrator ruled against you and you're taken to court, the courts will rule against you.
They probably will. But it's not an absolute certainty. It depends on a number of elements in the decision and whether you can substantiate that there was an error in judgment on the part of the arbitrator.
It's just very hard for the loan
It's not easy. Say it was.
Well, let me ask you, what triggered your own involvement in homeowner association and condo problems? You've got a wonderful background. You're probably one of the most knowledgeable people in Florida and maybe nationally. So what brought you into this issue?
Well, I guess I could blame it on my wife for buying a retirement home down here when we moved in, and the board seemed reasonably competent. And then a new board came in and seemed outstandingly incompetent in my judgment and very sneaky. And they wanted to do things without due process. They didn't want to follow the rules. So we tried to get them to follow the rules, and when that didn't work, we arranged a recall and got rid of them.
Well, you make it sound easy, but I know it wasn't easy at all for you. You fought a very hard battle. Can you give us a little background? I mean, what's your educational background? I know you have a PhD, of course. I want to share that with our listeners. You're an economist. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, aside from being charming and handsome, which doesn't matter in these cases, basically, yes, I have a earned doctorate in economics, but the degree isn't as important as the actual class training, where my experience turned out to be surprisingly relevant. I have particular training in an area called the economics of regulation and in something called game theory, which is a way of analyzing very complicated situations, what the rules are and how they interplay. This second area, I attended law school for a while, didn't like it, and quit. But the basic knowledge stuck and has been very handy.
It's a rare combination, the two.
Yes.
Right.
And beyond that, I've had experience teaching at the graduate school level in game theory and ethics and a few other related fields. So the background training has been very helpful. Then for a number of years, I was a consultant to firms in various aspects of corporate governance. So the difference between the board of a for-profit company and a not-for-profit is relatively small. I also served on the board of a couple of professional societies and for many years was a member of the National Association of Corporate Directors. So
you're also very active with Cyber Citizens for Justice, which fights for homeowner rights in Florida. You're
yes,
a member of the board.
That's recent.
Right.
And that's only the last 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I got involved with that because I felt if I could be stressed by these situations, other people must be driven to despair, and I don't like that, and particularly people who are less able to protect themselves and are being harassed or picked upon.
Well, also, as I'm aware, you led a recall action. You mentioned it at the beginning of the show, but there was a great deal to it. And now I think some people would like to see you leave the community as soon as possible. You've even been threatened with a baseball bat, I understand.
Yes, someone was foolish enough to do that. But the first incident was after a heated board meeting where someone threatened to slap my wife around.
Oh,
and
my
that
Lord.
Was a mistake because Ellie told them that she did not have to resort to violence. She could just handle things with discussion. And it's too bad you can't, my dear. And that was a nice put down and it evoked an apology. But there was a recent board meeting where things were discussed, and one man on the other side after the meeting approached me and strongly disagreed with my views, and because I had circulated flyers stating my position to rouse the community, he also felt that I was trespassing on his property, and that if I ever did so again, he would use a baseball bat to keep me away. It's silly to make such threats, and it's also an expression of frustration and misunderstanding. So you have a poor misguided soul. The other thing is, if he did attack me, while I'm a little out of condition, at one point I used to teach martial arts, so I think I could handle myself with a guy in close quarter combat.
But it does bring up the danger that these issues are so contentious. People become so angry and excited that there have even been cases, I believe, across the country where several people have been shot.
Oh, yeah, shot, run over,
Run over? That one I hadn't heard.
Progress, trying to get a spouse to a hospital locked by another car. They've had all kinds of crazy incidents because people get very emotional, and they are unable to express themselves verbally or uncomfortable doing so, so they resort to violence or the threats of violence. It's counterproductive, but it's not that unusual.
Have you ever been lied to, libeled? Well, we know you've been threatened, but have you been libeled or lied to?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I've gotten feedback where people tell me I'm or circulate rumors that as to either my motives or my warped, perverted personality or some other such thing.
Well, I imagine that hurts when somebody circulates a flyer against you. You have to have very thick skin to keep fighting when that type of thing happens. How do you handle it?
Well, first of all, I'm not that gullible or vulnerable. To me, it just shows weaknesses on the other side that I can exploit. Because if they don't know what my motives are, it gives me an opportunity to explain and communicate since they opened the door.
But how do you do that? Let's say a homeowner's in that situation. They start to fight back, fight for their rights, and then suddenly they're being libeled throughout the community. What would you tell them to do in that case? They're fighting against illegal or unethical actions regarding the documents, and suddenly they find themselves the target.
Oh, I think the first thing to do is to stay calm and not take these things too seriously, at least the insults, lies, and so on. The second thing is to organize and get the facts out and stick to the facts. Don't get into personality disputes and discussions because it's not productive. And in the longer term, the facts will carry the day.
But how do they get the facts out, or how would you suggest they get the facts out? Most people, you're a wonderful writer, you've written numerous books. The book on creating homeowner and condo association documents is only one of your books. You're a prolific writer, but the average person finds it very difficult to write. How would you suggest they go about stating the facts to their fellow homeowners?
Well, if you get your friends and colleagues in the community who feel much the same way, you can usually start exploring the history of the situation and get a list of facts that way. Then it's a question of expressing them very briefly in writing. You might start a newsletter and circulate the facts and open the newsletter as a forum for discussion where anyone is welcome to submit material, provided it's not libelous or slanderous or something, you know, discriminatory. And you publish both sides of the issue. You shouldn't be afraid to take a position or to tolerate someone with an opposite point of view legitimately reached. Ultimately, the community has to decide by taking a vote, and you're entitled to lobby for your position. And you can do this by writing and putting out pamphlets. You can do it by holding coffee klatches and informal discussions. And the more, the merrier.
And maybe the real challenge for everybody is just to stay calm and cool and stick with the facts. Because oftentimes you'll see in such communications calling people terrible names, calling their foes the bad guys, no doubt, but nonetheless calling them horrific names and accusing
them
of many crimes.
Oh, yes, I've even seen racist slurs and sexist and nationality and so on. But the point fundamentally is these people are revealing that they don't have the facts and don't want to know. They just, you know, want to pick on other individuals. And that becomes very revealing, and it weakens their position immediately.
So stay firm, stay cool, and be objective. That would be a very big piece of advice that you're giving our listeners.
Oh, yes,
yeah.
And keep a record. Write things down so that when Joe Doakes gets up and gives a harangue, you should make note of it, that this is what was said on such and such a day. Of course, if it's in a publication, then just make sure you keep a copy in a safe place.
Now, the wonderful thing about your book is not a novel, it's not a whodunit, it's not something that you can read in one sitting and remember the punchline, but it's a tremendous resource. Every homeowner who lives in a condo or HOA should have a copy, and it probably represents years of your life in trying to put together what excellent documents should look like. As a matter of fact, I understand that a developer expressed interest in using your book as a template for a new homeowner association that he's created.
Yes, there's a developer out west that we're negotiating with on this particular point, and his reasoning is very interesting. His parents had a terrible experience in a homeowners association to the point where a normally polite, mild-mannered mother started cursing the developer who put in these terrible documents and let people do these terrible things. And this developer took the attitude he would never want anyone to be able to say such things about him. So therefore, partly in honor of his parents' bad experience, he wants to make sure that anyone who buys in his developments, you know, has a good chance at a happy and peaceful life there.
You know, I think this is a very important point, because developers have to realize, if nothing else, if the condo the people who live in the condo or the HOA that they create hate their guts for what they did, that's very bad karma for the future.
Well,
so,
it is, and it also means it's harder to resell. I'm making up numbers, but hypothetically, if you paid $1 million for a house in such a place, you're going to feel rather disappointed, because you are less likely to be able to sell it for that kind of money.
Perhaps, I know that, have you seen situations, have they been documented, where HOAs or condos with bad documents and lots of warfare, internal warfare, have actually lost value?
I've seen indications of it, but nothing absolutely convincing, because the real estate market is a very complex situation. But what I have seen and heard is people protesting that bad rules, bad governance leads to a loss of value of your home in a condo or a homeowners association.
And that would be, of course, because if they're so busy fighting each other, they're not maintaining the building, they're not maintaining it properly, they're probably misspending the money, mismanaging your money.
That's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But the other part is, who wants to walk into the middle of a Hatfield and McCoy feud?
Right. Another gentleman contacted me just yesterday, bought a condo, moved in December, had absolutely no idea what he was walking into, and has spent every hour since trying to understand the laws and the documents. And
well, there was something circulated today where a chap from Great Britain bought a home in such an organization in Florida, and he wanted to look at the documents on finances of the community, and was refused. And he spent almost $500,000 so far fighting for something that the state law says is not only explicitly his right, but to some extent he has an obligation to pay attention to as a resident.
Well, now, this man was willing to spend $500,000 to fight.
Well, $478,000 and change so far.
But okay, but where did he obtain? I mean, why would somebody spend such enormous money to fight for a principle that, by the way, is their right? Why would he do it?
Well, I think the main thing is he was obviously mistreated, and he is able to afford to spend that kind of money.
Lucky
man. This is an indication that the enforcement of existing law is pretty poor, and knowledge of what the laws require is poor, and especially among officers and directors of these associations.
Now, here's a gentleman who theoretically saw the documents before he moved in, or is it more typically the case that people are handed the documents once they've already purchased? Where do they see the documents? At what stage in the process?
You're supposed to see them some significant time before you make an irrevocable commitment to buy.
But when you do see them, you don't really know what they mean. Is that
the problem? That's the point. It takes time to read them and understand them, and even lawyers have trouble with this, and afterwards even judges where they're dealing with cases as to what the documents mean in a particular instance, because the documents are generally not well written. And as a consequence, if professionals have trouble with it, laymen are going to have a great deal more trouble. I've run into an instance where a homeowner insisted that a certain restriction was in the documents, namely a cap on spending on new capital investment and capital improvements, and it was not there. The restriction was strictly from a federal law, the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Act, which required a vote by the community and a separate vote by all the companies that hold mortgages before you could make a capital investment. So that the cap, in essence, was if you were spending 1 cent or more, you had to go get these votes of approval. This reduces the chance of making changes or alterations to the amount of land you hold by buying or selling, or the use of the land, or the appearance of it, so on. But a lot of boards simply disregard this. And
they
that's an improper use of community funds.
In other words, it's in the documents, but they ignore it.
Yep.
All right. Now,
first of all, it's troublesome to get a vote. And in one community I'm familiar with, people had attempted to make a change on three different occasions, were shot down in flames and votes three times, and decided we still want what we want. So what we're going to do is we're going to get it by getting control of the board, and we're going to ignore the rules. And that's exactly what they've done.
And they succeeded.
So far.
So far, because no one wants to stop them, and the state is really toothless.
Well,
in this case, I guess
that's part of it, but the other thing is, so far they've only squandered, by my estimate, about $25,000 to $30,000. But it would cost over $30,000 to take them to court. And, of course, there's no guarantee you'll win.
And then all the owners would have to chip in for that $30,000.
Well, the owners would have to be prepared to spend $30,000 while the board is going to spend $30,000 in defense, which they tax the same owners to pay.
Right, but where does the number $30,000 come up? Why would the owners have to spend $30,000?
Typically, the current cost of a significant lawsuit through appeal in Florida runs about $30,000.
Now, my board spent $30,000 against me.
Yeah.
And they lost.
Yeah,
but
they had to reimburse you for your legal expenses.
Well, no, they had to reimburse me because it was pro se, in a sense, fighting on our own without a Florida attorney. We were not reimbursed except for faxes and telephone calls.
Right, but
if you hire a lawyer, you'll receive your legal fees back.
If you win, but the point
if you win.
The point I'm making is that the protesting group has to put up a substantial sum in advance and take the chance that if they win, they will get their money back, plus a favorable judgment, of course. But if they lose, they're out of pocket for their expenses and the board's expenses,
right,
as well as now having an unfavorable ruling.
Right.
So there's a very strong deterrent against standing up for your rights. because A, it's expensive in money terms, and B, it's expensive emotionally, and C, it's slow. And, of course, it's also uncertain.
It's too bad there's not a fund available in each state that people can turn to borrow money or for grants to fight back. Because to do it as a lone individual, this woman who contacted me, she went to three different attorneys. They each quoted her $3,500 to write a simple letter, which, you know, we could write with our hands behind our back. But, I mean, it was an outrageous charge for a simple letter that might have saved her in this particular situation.
Well, let me put on my hat as an economist for a moment.
Okay.
There's a concept called stay-out pricing.
Mm-hmm.
And an attorney might very well think, hell, I can do this letter for $50 to $100. But that's going to lead to other things and further expenses. And I don't want to get involved as simply a letter writer. I want to handle major trial work in this area. If the people aren't serious and aren't willing to pay what it costs, I'm going to ask for an outrageous fee so they'll just go away.
That's a very interesting insight. I hope that lots of people are going to hear this and
understand
why they're being given such huge quotes.
This is part of the reason for it, but there are direct analogies in many other fields where the same principle is used. I mean, suppose you approach, let's say, General Motors and wanted a specialty car built. They're going to have to charge you full cost plus extra. They just may not want to tolerate the disruption. So they may figure very carefully the car will cost $200,000. They say, you know, ask for $1 million. If they're serious, fine. If they're not, let them go away.
Well, let's talk for a moment about some of your unconventional views. For instance, you seem opposed to such popular approaches to fix document problems as legislation, increased regulatory action, and even efforts by an ombudsman's office, if one exists, as it does in Florida, but may not exist, of course, in other states.
Or you don't have an ombudsman person in Florida to protect homeowners association residents, just condos.
Right. You have it for condos, but not HOA. So you've been really quite active in talking about legislations and the problems with legislation, whereas so many others think that that is the salvo. That's the solution. Can you talk about that?
Okay. Many years ago, I had a look at and model the federal legislative process. And to my surprise, I found out that while I thought it was intended to enact useful legislation, when you analyze it, it's intended to propose and kill useful legislation, barring extreme circumstances such as an act of war. The odds of a typical bill getting through Congress is approximately one chance in a million.
A typical bill.
A typical bill.
Good or bad bill. Doesn't matter.
Good or bad doesn't matter. I'm just saying on average.
On average, okay.
You know, you would see one bill passed for every million that are proposed and dropped or killed somewhere else. Now, the same principle applies at the state level. The odds might be a little different. Now, let's consider whether or not the bill is well written. That's one problem. Secondly, you could have a brilliantly written bill that's not funded or not enforceable, or simply, you know, put on the wayside, assuming it passes. Then you have a chance, of course, with a little effort, that you can get horse trading. So your brilliant bill suddenly gets watered down in key areas. And instead of accomplishing what you intended, you know, with, let's say, requiring people who steal money from homeowners associations and condominiums to repay and the full amount plus a fine, they're required to apologize and repay 10 cents on the dollar. So in effect, that could be a license to steal. So you have all of these problems, in addition to which, the legislators generally don't know what's needed because they're relying on lobbyists and they're relying on homeowners who are intensely concerned with an immediate individual problem rather than the underlying causes of the problem. Work I've done suggests that we have at least 13 different major causes of trouble in homeowner and condominium associations. And if you don't address all of them correctly, the trouble will crop up in the missing area. So legislation has a number of weaknesses besides being slow as molasses on a cold winter day. The same sort of thing crops up with regulatory agencies. There's a classic game called Capture the Regulator, where you either have a member of your firm in early retirement placed on the regulatory board or court, or you turn around and you make a deal that when you're through with your 2, 3, 4 years here, come to work for us. Well, this tends to bias people's judgment. Then, of course, the governor can always play games with the budget, and you have a situation, for example, with bridges in one state that I read recently. Typically, if a team was expected to inspect 12 bridges a week, but there was a budget crisis, so they were rescheduled to do 20.
And what?
What they did is they lied. They said we inspected these bridges, and they didn't because it was a physical impossibility to do that much work. They'd have been fired anyway.
Well, you're painting a very vivid picture because I think that most people, including myself, it's hard to imagine that so many bills fail. I think that that's a concept that isn't in most people's minds, that one out of, 100 bills might actually get through, and by the time it gets through, it's so watered down and complicated that it might do more to harm you than help you.
Well, that's part of it, and often, as originally designed, the legislative process was intended to delay action in the hope that either it would, the passions of the moment would burn out, or the urgency of the problem would pass, or more important things would crop up. If you want legislation to protect your place against peeling paint, and someone else comes along and says, "I want in Florida, let's say tornado and hurricane protection," I think you'll find the latter would take precedence over the peeling paint issue. So even though a legislator might promise to enact or propose a law, he's going to have to set priorities. So that your process is deficient by design, although most people don't realize this.
And of course in Florida where the legislation produced an ombudsman's office and an ombudsman and a staff. Nevertheless, so many people are suffering terribly because the ombudsman does not have enforcement capability.
Well, that's not all. The ombudsman office has a budget problem, has a problem with getting adequate staff, is a political appointee rather than having independent authority, and is involved with a turf battle with the Department of Business and Professional Regulation. And in any event, overcome all of those problems, and they're still dealing with issues one by one rather than underlying causes. The most they can do is recommend legislative change.
But what would you recommend instead of legislative change, in place of legislative change?
I think there are two alternate approaches that are more likely to work effectively and faster. One we've mentioned, and that is getting developers to change the documents. And the second is to, as homeowners in a community find themselves unhappy, they should organize, recall their board, restore good people to the board, and then amend their documents along the lines I've suggested in my book, and some updates to it.
And I want to mention that...
The thing most people don't realize is you don't have to change just one item in the governing documents. You have to replace a lot of it. And part of it has to be to clarify ideas and terms and relationships. The second is to make sure the board has enough power to do its job, and that job has to be defined very clearly, but no more power than that, so that it doesn't have the ability for selective enforcement or harassment. And you have to write the documents in a way where they're self-enforcing.
David,
and that's an interesting problem in and of itself.
Right. You're not an attorney. I'm not an attorney. But I want to mention at this point in the program that we do provide a consultation service for condo owners and HOA members, very inexpensive, a token payment to spend an hour with us on the phone, walking through their problems and trying to give them helpful guidance, non-legal guidance, of course, because we're not attorneys. But if somebody's interested, they should go to Star Publications, S-T-A-R-R, Publications.com, and look for the homeowner teleconsultation. And David will be leading that teleconsultation with his tremendous experience. David, let's talk about you as an author. You've published three very different books and are now working on a fourth. Tell us a bit about them.
Well, the first book was a bit of a surprise to me because I was working on my doctoral dissertation, and one of the stages that you go through is you have a committee review this and critique it. And to my surprise, the discussion centered on which publisher I should deal with. And it suddenly hit me, I've got it made? And then, oh my God, all this extra work to get it published, but I got that done. And my doctoral dissertation is one of the few that's been published and reasonably well accepted, I gather.
What's the title of it?
Royalty. The U.S. Man-Made Fiber Industry.
Ah, okay.
We won't go into that, but let me assure the audience, if you borrow it from the library, I pretty much guarantee you won't have problems with insomnia after reading it a bit.
But you've also written a book about Sun Tzu. And
yes, for many years I did consulting and governance and strategic planning. And a client asked me to rework Sun Tzu's book. It's a classic on military strategy that was written some 2,500 years ago and is still very widely read, not only by career military people, but increasingly by business people. Especially in Japan and the rest of the Orient, but also in Europe and to a growing extent in the U.S. My client was a senior exec at a Japanese firm. His feeling was that, first of all, war is not necessarily a good model for business because business people are trying to build things and military people are trying to destroy them. Secondly, the book was written a while ago. Surely there's something new to discuss. And I'd like to know what that is. The third issue he pointed out is that in his repeated readings of this as required by his employer, there seemed to be some gaps, and there wasn't sure whether they were deliberate omissions or accidental loss due to just the age of the book and some parts of it got lost in the mist of time. And in reworking it, I shifted the model from a military model to a commercial model, and I updated it. And then I tackled the gaps, and I began to realize that those gaps were probably deliberate as part of a sales pitch, because this was the first self-help book ever written.
2,500 years ago.
2,500 years ago, there was a young Chinese military officer who needed a job out of town, and the only way to get it was to distinguish himself from his colleagues. So he wrote one of the first books on strategy and the first comprehensive book on strategy, showing that he could deal with all kinds of new problems, but he didn't show the answers to every problem, just enough to make it clear that he really did know what he was talking about. And if you wanted to find out the answers to the pressing problems of the day, you're going to have to hire him. But only one person can do that.
A very clever guy.
Oh, yeah. And the amazing thing is he was 24 years old when he wrote the book.
And you're the person who has updated that book.
Yes.
That's amazing.
And it was a very interesting exercise to fill in the gaps, and I had a good time doing it. The kicker was some very distinguished colleagues helped, including a Nobel Prize laureate in economics, and that was a pleasure and a privilege. The third book you know about because you published it, and that's this book on the guide rules for amending your documents.
Right.
That we've discussed a bit. The fourth one, over the course of my career, I've had a number of incidents where I didn't dare laugh at the time, but I thought the circumstances were screamingly funny, and I took some notes. So now I'm writing these humorous incidents down in published form, and so I hope that some people will find out that business is not only an interesting area, but at times a very funny one, even outside of the business of performing arts.
Well, I hope we're going to build up a fan club for you, and that people will come to Star Publications for your humor book as well, because I know you're one of the funniest people I've met. And you keep me laughing.
Well, you're just mixing with bad company.
Right. Now, going back to the homeowner documents, we have about roughly 5 more minutes. What are the 3 most important things you'd advise people do to protect their rights in a condo or HOA situation?
First of all, you have to know what your rights are, and that means you've got to read and understand the relevant law and your documents. And you've got to go over those until you understand them. And that takes work. But it's worthwhile. The second thing is you've got to organize in the community, because unless you're the only resident eligible to vote, which is probably the developer, you need a majority or a supermajority of the votes. So it's very important that you make your case clearly and concisely and convincingly to the other members of the community. You won't win all of them over, because nobody will get a unanimous approval except under incredibly rare circumstances. But you need at least a majority to stop trouble.
But one of the problems that many people have, I faced it and others facing it daily, people don't want to open their doors, they don't want to sign anything, and they don't want to know.
Yep. Well, let's put it this way. That's their right, but they're going to pay very dearly for it when they get enormous bills or loss of privilege. Somebody may decide that we really need a tennis court, and as long as we need it, we should have it accessible 24 hours a day, which means exterior lighting. So now you find community property converted to build a tennis court and put up very powerful lights, and somebody in the community may be very light sensitive and had previously stayed home in the daytime and went out at night. Now they can't go out at night.
And can they
and they, of
the
course, get their share of the bill for the tennis courts, the installation of the lights, and the electric power needed to run it.
But they could also sue the association.
Not if it was done legally.
Uh-huh. Okay.
If you don't stand up and vote and make your views clear and muster enough people, you're in trouble. We had an incident in one community that I'm familiar with where a group got control of the board and repeatedly proclaimed, "We are the majority. We know what the majority of the community wants. We represent them. And we know what everyone will think when they see what we've done." You're not going to get a chance to vote in advance, of course. And we got a majority of the people together, and forced it to a vote and got them out.
And that took a lot of effort and time.
Yes, it took several months of fairly hard work, but if you know how to do it and you know what's at risk, which can be the total value of your home and all your assets, theoretically a board can in effect command everyone to chip in everything they've got, at least till the poorest person goes bankrupt. And then the rest of the people have to pick up the slack.
So By itself, that's a rather shocking thought, that it's not only a lien that they could bring or a foreclosure against you, but they could actually run your river dry by simply creating more and more demands on the condo or the homeowner association.
Yeah, they could hire an organization to provide services at astronomical fees. They could put up a very expensive project, let's say a greenhouse to raise exotic fish to give away to visitors. So you start raising, I think it's Korean koi or Chinese, they're a form of carp that cost a couple $1,000 a piece. So you put in all kinds of special equipment for that. It's not for profit. You raise the money for charity and give it away.
In order to bankrupt the condo or HOA.
Sure. I mean, if you want to be sneaky about it, that's one way to go.
So perhaps you have a deal with a developer behind the scenes and somebody's waiting to step in, so you simply you're on the board, you're controlling it, and you bankrupt everybody.
That's right.
Doesn't require
a hurricane. Or you siphon money out. I've heard tales from a friend who's in an organization where the owners are wealthy and indifferent, and allegedly they're being ripped off to the tune of a couple $1 million a year.
They're that wealthy that they don't mind?
They're wealthy enough to afford it and lazy enough or indifferent not to care, because while the total is supposedly around $3 million a year, spread out over a couple of hundred owners, they don't see it as that much.
The problem is that the majority are not able to sustain that type of
This is a very wealthy community.
Right, but
the point is, in a typical community,
mm-hmm.
you couldn't sustain that for very long. Couldn't afford it.
Just in the last few minutes that we have here, so many people are either elderly or their English is not their first.
Or they're not fluent in English,
exactly.
Or they're not literate at all.
Fluent in English, I was going to say English is not their first language. For example, many people in this particular area where I live are Hispanic, and they don't read the notices, because until only recently, all the notices were in English. Now they're in Spanish, too, but still people don't read.
Yeah, the other problem is a lot of this is technical jargon.
Mm-hmm.
If you come from a different culture, not only are you stuck with the jargon problem, but the cultural principles underlying it are very different. In many other countries, laws and rules are negotiable. Here, they're relatively strictly interpreted. And that puts, a very different complexion on the situation for people from a different culture.
They really don't understand what's happening to them.
Until it's too late.
Until it's too late. A little girl in a no-pet community, the little child gets a tiny little dog, and then is told after 6 months, you're going to be fined $100 a day for the dog, or parents are told that. Well,
yep.
It breaks the child's heart. They have to give away the dog, and the mother doesn't understand, the father doesn't understand where the rule came from, because they do see a few pets on the premises. Little do they understand that those pets were grandfathered in at some prior time, but not their pet, because it's new.
And that's part and parcel of the problem. And you can take it to the opposite extreme. There are people who walk in and buy because they see it as a bargain. and their attitude is, I don't give a bloody hoot what the rules are. I'm above and beyond the law. I will do what I please no matter what. Go ahead, make me. Take me to court, I dare you.
And what's the moral of that story as we're now coming to our final 30 seconds here?
Well, as the picture on one of my lawyer's walls indicated, with a very staid British judge in full robes and wig, sue the bastard. You need to set an example. And sometimes, unfortunately, the board is right in enforcing laws and being harsh, because if you don't enforce them regularly and even-handedly, you lose authority in that area.
But that assumes a board that's well-intended, and as we both know,
oh, yes,
the problem is across the country there are more boards that aren't well-intended, perhaps. We don't actually have a count, and that's what most people are dealing with.
Well, you're dealing with a classic question. Which is better, a corrupt, competent government or a very ethical, utterly incompetent one?
Right.
This first time I ran across this was a write-up by one of the famous American muckrakers, Lincoln Stevens. He's quite famous in these circles. He talked about a New York cop who was utterly honest, and no matter what the administration was like, you know, Tammany Hall or reform, this man rose through the ranks for outstanding performance. Because both sides made equally good use of them to send them in to clean up the place.
All right. Well, David, we're going to have to sign off now, but I hope that people are going to call you to help them clean up their mess, and they can contact you through starpublications.com, S-T-A-R-R, publications.com, and David is the author of Creating Homeowner and Condo Association Documents, which you can find on our site or on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. And, David, it's been absolutely wonderful talking with you.
Well, thank you,
so much for your time.
And good evening to everyone else.
Right. And this is Dr. Joyce Starr wishing you a lovely evening. If you're listening at what is now 6 o'clock Eastern Standard Time for Rights Radio for Homeowners in Distress. Bye-bye.
Bye.